Hey, good morning, colleagues, members of the audience. Welcome to this June 3rd, 2013 meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. We have before us today an informational session with two parts. One is going to be devoted to the issue of student visas, foreign student visas on our college campuses, and the second, our long-awaited overview of Oregon's independent colleges and universities. Let me say also, colleagues, that Wednesday will be our last informational session of this session, and we will have a couple of conversations, one related to financial aid, student loans in particular on campus, and another we will be hearing from teacher standards and practices, Vicki Chamberlain. We weren't able to hear from her last week when we talked about schools of education. Between now and then, if you have any thoughts of what we should be putting on our calendar for interim informational hearings, we can spend a couple of minutes on that as well as talk about our end of session committee party, which I'm trying to get set up for next week, and we'll hear more about that.
I think Vic said he'd take the lead on that.
I'm counting on him. I'm counting on him to be involved heavily in this party.
Mr. Chair, yes. We spent a lot of time, and I know it's your a focus of yours too, is about helping with tuition. Is our bill still alive in ways and means as far as having an interim report on?
It is, and I'll do that on Wednesday as well, is give you a review of where our bills are, you know, that came out of this committee. Those that went over to the Senate and those that went down in Ways and Means. Okay, so with that, let me open the informational meeting and let's turn to the first topic, which we've titled Control, Monitoring, and Reporting of Student Visas. This is a topic that was requested by Representative Wisnant, and so I want to turn it over to him for a couple of minutes just to bring us into this topic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, honorable colleagues, we all know that what happened on 9/11 in Boston and all the information that came out of there. I talked to the chair about introducing a priority bill to ask us to receive information as far as I think the public should know how we are doing in Oregon as far as monitoring the student visas. And I had a meeting with Mrs. Burns from OUS, and she assured me and gave me a lot of good data about what they're doing in this program. And based upon that verbal report to me, I said, well, let's just have a hearing in coordination with Chair Denbrough. And so that's what we're doing today. I've done some research. It's F1 is the visas, and there's a long process about how it works. I gave you some information, a couple of reports today. There were several I found from May the 4th. I don't know why May the 4th was the date that this sort of got back on the front burner of the press attention. But I think I have some questions we'll ask and find out how it's going. But it's something we should be aware of. If we go back to the original 9/11, those people were also in the United States. Those terrorists were in the United States on student visas, were involved in that. So thank you. Good morning for coming.
Good morning. Oh, my pleasure.
But I look forward to the testimony. I hope you share with me that this is something that the people of Oregon, we should maybe report to them about how we've had the hearing and how it's looks like it's being monitored by our institutions. Because I gave you a copy of one press report today, Chris. I have one from the Boston Globe, and but there's a lot of people in the United States on student visas, a lot of people, and thank the chair for agreeing to have this hearing, and I hope you find it informative, and we can, like I said, I think then it should be a basis for us to report to our constituents about that we do have a good system and we're concerned about it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Before we call up the first panel, let me say that we had hoped to have representatives here from the Department of Homeland Security. In the end, the schedule didn't align for them. They did send a document, which I think, Victoria, you've put up on OLIS. Could you just tell us about it for the record?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Department of Homeland Security submitted two documents, which we posted on OLIS. One is a written testimony presented to the House Committee on Homeland Security, Subcommittee on Border and Maritime Security, titled Visa Security and Overstays, How Secure is America? And that was, that testimony took place on May 21st, 2013, and discussed exactly the same issues we're talking about here. The second document is a fact sheet on CVIS reporting requirements for designated school officials, which is, to my understanding, is a fact sheet that they provide to the schools who are certified to accept students studying in the United States under student visas, and I believe that our witnesses have also seen these documents and may refer to them in terms of what is on them. They, as I said, they are both available on OLIS, so you can take a look at them there.
Thank you very much, Victoria. Okay, so I'd like to call up Joe Holliday and Christina Luther, please.
Good morning. Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Holliday. I serve the Oregon University system as Assistant Vice Chancellor for Student Success Initiatives. And I'll be very brief before handing it off to my very knowledgeable colleague, Christina Luther, who really has the knowledge and experience that I think you are seeking to get some clarity on. So, Oregon University system, as of fall 2012, had about 7,500 international students enrolled. That's about 7% of our enrollment. That's about it has almost doubled in the last 10 years, so it has increased dramatically for us. By far, the largest group of students studying at Oregon University System institutions is from China. It really dwarfs all the other countries' enrollment. And then the other countries in the top five of enrollment are Saudi Arabia, South Korea, India, and Japan. So that's kind of the overview. Almost all of this enrollment is at our three large universities. Each of our three large universities has more than 2,000 international students, and then just a smattering at the other institutions. And I think that's all I really wanted to say, other than that perhaps stating the obvious, but bringing in international students certainly contributes to the diversity mission at all of our universities. It fosters intercultural understanding and communication, and it even has an economic impact, not just in terms of our tuition revenue, but also an impact in the Oregon economy. And I think Christine is going to talk about that as well. So I can just pause there for questions you might have, and then I can turn it over to Christina.
Thanks, Jay. Okay. Rep. Wisland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor Holliday, we were talking beforehand. Has this spiked the enrollment? Has it been consistent growth, and what do you see for the future?
Right. Chair Dembrough, Representative Wisland, members of the committee, it's a little bit of a dip after about 2002. It dipped and then started straight up around 2004, 2005. So it's been on a steady increase for the last 7 or 8 years.
Follow up. I know that because a lot of members of this organization, of the legislature, have gone to China, and we had the student visa problem, and David always discussed that. So I think after the original 9/11, there was a lot of hold back, and let's look at this. But that's sort of changed now. Would you agree?
Yes, Chair Dembrough, representative members of the committee. That's right. After 9/11, 2001, that was clearly what caused the dip, and that it has been growing, and the problem's really kind of gone away there.
Thank you.
Rep. Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair. I'm assuming that they pay out-of-state tuition, or are there other expenses or fees that they pay?
Sure. Chair Dembrough, Rep. Gallegos, members of the committee, they generally pay non-resident tuition rates, although I believe at least one of our universities, Eastern Oregon University, has an international student tuition rate. And there are other fees. For example, international students have to have proof of and have to have much more insurance upon arrival, and they also have to prove that they can pay their first year of expenses. and which are, those two things are different than for domestic students.
And just to follow up to that, I realize we don't have someone from an independent college. I don't know, Larry, you're prepared to, or you may know. Is there a different rate for international students who are attending at independent colleges? Do they tend to pay more, or?
Larry, I think I will defer to Larry on that.
Do you mind coming up, Larry? Sorry. We have many international students at independent universities as well, I believe.
For the record, I'm Larry Large, president of the Alliance, sometimes known as the Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities. Yes, we do have international students, and our tuition fees are set constant. They do not differentiate for international students. But like Joe mentioned, it is the case that we require insurance and other validation of their capacity to pay when they arrive.
Thank you.
Great.
Right. Christina, go ahead. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christina Luther. I am the Associate Director in the Office of International and Student and Scholar Services at Portland State University. Thank you very much for inviting me to provide some information about the student visa process. I'm quite familiar with the process as this has been my primary work at Portland State for 15 years. There's been quite a bit of misinformation in the press lately about students and their visas, so I'm glad to be here to help clarify some of that information. I'd like to begin by explaining the process by which international students gain admission to the United States. Once a U.S. institution has found an international applicant to be admissible and to have sufficient funding for a year of study, a record is created in the Department of Homeland Security database, CVIS. This document is called an I-20. A prospective international student uses the I-20 to apply for an F-1 student visa at a U.S. consulate or embassy abroad. The visa is an entry document. It allows the holder to request entry to the United States in a particular classification. If the applicant is given an F-1 visa, the prospective student may travel to the United States. At the border, the prospective student is required to present Customs and Border Protection officers a valid passport, an I-20, and the F-1 visa. CBP officers review these documents, and if they find the individual to be a bona fide student, the individual is admitted to the United States in the F-1 or student classification. At this point, the validity of the visa is no longer relevant as it is only an entry document. At the border, immigration status is conferred. If an individual is properly admitted to the United States in student status, they may remain here as long as they maintain that student status. F-1 students are required to report to their schools within 30 days of the start of their programs of study. At that time, we review the immigration documents to make sure they've been properly adjudicated, and we collect students' local addresses. School officials are then required to report to the federal government that students have arrived on campus, have registered for classes, and have established a local residence. If a student enters the United States using our documentation but fails to report to a campus in a timely manner, we are obliged to report that student to the federal government as a no-show. This reporting will likely alert immigration and customs enforcement officers to a problem, and the student's whereabouts will be sought.
Christina, excuse me. To whom do you report this information? Is it Department of Homeland Security?
The Department of Homeland Security through the CVIS database. After the initial registration of our new students in CVIS, we are required to report each academic term whether or not each student has registered, and if so, to report they are enrolled full-time. In Oregon, this reporting happens at least 3 times a year at the beginning of each academic quarter. At some schools, the reporting happens 4 times a year. At language schools, this reporting may happen as frequently as monthly. If students are enrolled part-time, there must be a documented reason for the part-time enrollment, or we are required to report a status violation to the government. Just a quick aside note, in the documentation that Representative Wisnat handed out this morning, there is reference to a school revoking a student's visa. Schools do not have the power to revoke a student's visa. We merely report a status violation. Additionally, we are required to report such events as changes of major or level of study, transfer to a new institution, failure on the part of a student to register for classes, failure to complete a full course of study, and many other such occurrences. If a student changes his place of residence, he is required to report the new address to his international office within 10 days of moving. International student advisors are obliged to report any of these changes to the federal government via CBUS within 21 days of learning of them. In most cases, we are much quicker with our reporting. At the beginning of my statement, I mentioned the misinformation that has abounded in the media since Jokhar Tsarnaev's friends were arrested. The media has made reference to individuals entering the United States with expired visas or being allowed to remain here long after their visas had expired. In the 15 years I've been doing this work, I've seen a lot, but I have never seen a student admitted with an expired visa. I have, however, seen many students admitted who have valid visas and I-20s, which appear to be valid, but CBUS records which indicate a status violation. This is because CBP officers have until very recently not had sufficient access to the CBUS database. They have not been able at primary inspection to see if a student's immigration is still active or has been terminated. I understand that in the last 2 weeks this has changed. Officers at primary inspection can now determine if a student's record is active or terminated, and if it is terminated, I understand the individual will be directed to secondary inspection for closer review. I've been working in international education for 16 years, all of them in the state of Oregon. In that time, I've gotten to know thousands of international students. I believe very strongly in the power of educational diplomacy. While these students contribute massively to our economy, international students and their families are estimated to have contributed more than $300 million to the Oregon economy in 2011 and 12. I know their contributions are far more immeasurable. They bring global perspectives to our campuses. They provide us with an opportunity to get to know perceived enemies and to realize that we frequently have the same hopes and dreams for our futures and our families. These young people are the most highly scrutinized population of non-immigrants in the United States. I fear that if they come under much more scrutiny, we run the risk of losing them and all that they contribute to our world. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Luther. That was very helpful. Questions? Yes, perfect.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a little niggling detail. You talked about having to report no-shows or the requirement that no-shows be reported. Is that a... I imagine it's a pretty infrequent experience around here. Am I right?
Thank you, Representative Harper, Chair Dembro. That is a very infrequent occurrence. When students enter the United States at the port of entry, a notation is made in their CBUS record indicating that they've entered the United States using our documents. I would estimate at Portland State we have maybe one or two students a year who enter the United States using our immigration documents and then drift off into the ether somewhere. And as I mentioned, we report those students through the CBUS database, and we frequently get calls from Immigration and Customs Enforcement quite soon after we make those reports.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm. Please.
Is there any pattern to nation of origin for those students?
Thank you again, Representative Harper. Chair Dembro, there, I have not seen any pattern to that.
Rep. Wilson?
Go ahead. You want to go first? Oh, no, I was just also pointing out Rep. Gallegos would like to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Luther, my intent is not to stop international students. I have a background, significant background in international affairs in the military. I served in the embassy. My wife has attended the consular course. So I'm not saying I don't want international students. It only takes one apple, and I'm sure you would have terrible misgivings if something happened to one student that you went through the system. And I think every testimony that I've heard and read that talks about the system is is full. It's overwhelmed for the people doing it, and there's going to be changes made. So I appreciate your testimony. It's been very good, and like I said, based upon Mrs. Burns' testimony to me, I felt a lot more comfortable. But this is one. This is an area that one mistake could be, you know, really devastating. So I hope you appreciate that, and that's the reason for the request to, for you to come in and talk to us about this. Could you explain the difference between an F1 and an M1 visa?
Thank you, Representative Wisnett. Chair Dembrough, that's a question I wasn't anticipating, but I will do my best. I'm not as familiar with the M1 category as I am with the F1. I think the easiest way to explain the difference between the M1 and the F1 category would be to say that the F1 category is primarily an academic category, so individuals applying for the F1 visa enter the United States to pursue academic courses of study, whereas the M1 visa is for vocational courses of study, and those individuals enter the United States to do various types of vocational training as opposed to the more academic.
It was in the testimony from the Homeland Security. I had not seen that number either.
I don't believe we have many M1s in the state of Oregon.
I wonder if that's used to attend community colleges.
It is not.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
You mentioned you have to report in this in timely manner, and I have the utmost confidence you're doing that, and based upon also the testimony from our meeting with Mrs. Burns. One of the things that we'll look at Boston is going from full-time to part-time. Mm-hmm. And do you think you have a handle on that? And you've actually got 9 universities, 3 big ones, but also I know that Southern Oregon, Western Oregon have a large, significant population, too, that they're out recruiting. So.
Thank you for the question, Representative Wisnett. Chair Dembrough, I am very confident that at Portland State, we have a very close handle on those students who may enroll full-time and drop to part-time. We run enrollment lists on a weekly basis. We send emails to students who we see have dropped from full-time to part-time. If we can't reach the students by email, we call them. We make every effort to find out primarily from humanitarian reasons, why a student may have dropped from full-time to part-time. That usually indicates that something's going on with the student. They're having a family problem, they're ill, they're suffering from culture shock. Generally speaking, those are the grounds why an individual will drop from full-time to part-time. But we keep a very close eye on that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair.
Please follow up.
Without getting into any sensitive information, do you receive any special training, or is someone at the Oregon University system receive any special training of what to look for, alerts from DHS? Is there any training or manuals or seminars on things you should be looking for?
Thank you, Representative Wisnett. Chair Dembrough, it's interesting that you posed that question. I just returned from a week-long conference in St. Louis. The NAFSA, Association of International Education, provides training for new designated school officials. I led one of those trainings, an 8-hour training myself. Representatives from the Department of Homeland Security, Student and Exchange Visitor Program, Immigration Customs Enforcement, Customs and Border Patrol, representatives from the Department of State were all present at that training. The Student and Exchange Visitor Program has 2 online manuals that they prepare for designated school officials. There's also an online webinar type training that the Student and Exchange Visitor Program has put together for designated school officials, and they require that we go through that before we are designated as school officials. There isn't anything official that the Oregon University system does to train international student advisors, but because I have been working in this field for 15 years in Oregon, I can confidently say that we, at least at the Oregon University systems, we're a very closely knit group of people, and we confer with each other frequently. Whenever anything arises that we're not sure of, we confer with each other, and also with the local immigration officers who we've developed relationships with.
J- Joe, you want to follow?
Yes, Chair Dembrough, representative members of the committee. As you probably have discerned from Christina's comments, this is something that is at the institutional level. It's not a system level activity.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair,
yes.
I would appreciate if Director Luther would provide us that organization you said you just attended, maybe so we could Google that and look at on that the one you just attended, and follow up, and I'll stop. Thank you for coming to testify today. Again, my intent was to be sure that we, as representing the people in the state of Oregon, feel that we have a program that's working. Again, from my background, I would encourage you to continue and maybe even have the university system put out some meetings or seminars and things to look for. I think that, to me, address changes and going from full-time to part-time would be suspicious of a student. And I'd want to know why that's happening. And I'm sorry the world is like it is today, that we have to be concerned about that for a few people, a few bad apples, when we know that there's a great benefit from international relations and international students. But I appreciate the testimony, and I think that I feel good. But I think something we should continue to work on and to be preventive. And I think that your background and these things, we could maybe make it as a university system to just part of your, you know, welcoming and looking for the advantages, to also be aware that there's bad apples, and we need to be sure that we have some training or some way to look at those, because I think what I'm reading is the system is overwhelmed, and that even though we have all these computers and everything, that's just not talking to each other and getting things done that prevent what occurred in Boston. But thank you very much.
Rep. Gallegos.
Yes, thank you, Chair. It's sort of a different tact. I really am a fan of international students. I appreciate them in the classroom greatly. They're like community college transfers or adult students. They're much more invested in learning and so on, it seems to me. But my question has to, I don't know if you track this or not, but do you track at all? Do you have any awareness of, say, the percentage of international students who remain in the country? Say, for example, they might get an internship or a practicum and then go to work for an agency or company and then move on to getting a green card. Is that anything you are aware of or can track at all?
Chair Dembrough, Rep. Gallegos, members of the committee, I think that is one of the things that the statewide longitudinal data system might be able to do for us, at least if the graduates stay in Oregon. But we don't currently track that beyond graduation.
So, follow-up, Chair. So there is data related to that, correct?
Yes. When the statewide longitudinal data system becomes fully operational, if a graduate is employed in Oregon, we'll know exactly.
Okay. So, beyond Oregon. It'll be interesting to see that. Yeah. Thank you.
With the current status, just to clarify, once a student leaves your institution, you lose contact with them, lose responsibility for them. Is that correct, Christine?
Chair Dembrough, that's actually not immediately correct. If a student applies for the training that Representative Gallegos mentioned, if they are in a non-STEM field, they are eligible for 12 months of work authorization upon graduation. We remain responsible for reporting on those students during that 12-month period. If they are in a STEM field and are working for an employer who participates in the E-Verify system, they become eligible for an additional 17 months of practical training for a total of 29 months. We are responsible for tracking and reporting on those students for that 2.5-year period beyond graduation from our institution. Now, that tracking takes a much more, I would say, hands-off approach at that point. There's no more enrollment requirement. We're not in regular contact with those students. However, the requirement that they update their addresses with us within 10 days remains constant, and they are also required to report which employer they are currently working with. So the schools have access to that information through that 29-month period beyond graduation.
Can I follow up a bit on that?
Please.
Yeah, I mean, so what I'm thinking about is, it'd be great if that data and we can track that eventually, because I think one of the things that, that I have concern about is in terms of workforce development, if a lot of these folks are coming over and then taking jobs, say at Intel or Nike or whatever, some of these STEM jobs, are they really taking jobs that our Oregonians could be taking? So that's one question I think that this data might help us to address. Thank you.
Rip Gorsuch.
A couple of quick things. We were talking about the F1, M1. We have some students that are out in Troutdale that just are learning how to fly. Is it possible that that might be an M1 sort of example?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Second thing, the second thing is in terms of Portland State University, I know that you said that you know you only have a couple usually on an annual basis that kind of disappear. How many? What's the count for the total number of international students at PSU in any given year?
Thank you, Representative Gorsuch. Chair Dembrough, we have currently a few more than 2,100 international students at Portland State.
Quite a few.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, the other questions brought up some things. Mr. Chair, would it be appropriate to ask President Large to maybe give us a report in writing or something on the independent schools of how they're any issues or if you feel comfortable in doing that would be helpful just to because you're a large part of the student.
Just the time inventory here.
Yeah.
Representative Whitney, Chair Dembrough, altogether out of 33,000 plus students, we have 1,252 international students. And it's we can certainly provide you with the kind of report you're asking for in writing, and I'm very happy
I think,
happy
Mr. Chair, what we're after, you know, is we have a program, we're complying, we see, you know, we know that this is important.
Yes. No, our, Chancellor Holliday said, this is traditionally been very much a campus-based issue with a direct relationship with the federal authorities at various levels. And so sometimes it's hard to aggregate data to give a kind of general answer to your question. But to the extent that those data are available, I will provide those to you in writing.
Yeah. And, Mr. Chair, the final thing is, in my work in international affairs in the Pentagon, we had a lot of countries would send diplomats here for medical treatment. How are international students handled as far as medical insurance? And do you have any, you know, a lot of cases, too many cases where they come here and have serious illnesses or anything like that?
I could start answering that, Chair Dembrough, representative members of the committee. I mentioned earlier in testimony that international students must have comprehensive health insurance. That's a condition of enrollment.
Thank you. I'm sorry. But they're home. You don't provide.
Well, they certainly have access to student health centers and to medical treatment just as anyone else
insurance.
Would. But they have full comprehensive health insurance upon entry.
I'm sorry. I missed that.
No.
Representative Wisnett, if I may comment further, there is an Oregon administrative rule that requires all F-1 visa holders and their dependents to have health insurance for the duration of the time that they are, and this is important language, on a document issued by an Oregon University System school. So that means it carries over into that practical training period. At Portland State University, we require all of our international students to carry the Portland State University health insurance, with the exception of those students who are sponsored by their governments, because we've reviewed the government health insurance and have deemed it to be in line with the health insurance that we require at Portland State. And that health insurance is for all of our students. It's, of course, optional for the domestic students in some cases, but required for the international. In the 15 years that I've been doing this job, I would say there have been a handful, maybe two or three students who have not been able to continue their studies because of health issues, and it's things like cancer that crop up. I am comfortable saying there are no abuses to that.
Thank you.
Rick Johnson.
Thanks, Chair. Two questions. Ms. Luther, do you have any kind of regularly scheduled communication with your counterparts on other university campuses just to kind of trade best practices or track trends that you may be seeing across Oregon?
Thank you, Representative Johnson, Chair Dembro. We do in that we have this national NAFSA conference. We also have a regional NAFSA conference, which occurs in the fall. In addition to that, we have in the past had regular meetings, at least of the three advisors from the three large institutions. We will be having one of those meetings on August 7th. The international student advisors from the three institutions will get together to share best practices. I also wanted to share with the committee that our professional association has national roles. One of them is the Knowledge Committee for International Student and Scholar Services. Each of the 12 regions of the professional association has one representative. I am that representative right now for Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Alaska. And so any international student advisors who have questions about interpreting the federal regulations or applying them to their institution or to a particular situation can call me and ask me for assistance with figuring out how to apply those regulations. And if I can't figure it out, then I'll call my colleagues at the national level.
Great, thank you. One more follow-up. Mm-hmm. And Joe, a question for you from the OUS perspective. Seems to me that if we add the numbers of international students plus the numbers of out-of-state students, we're talking about a fairly large population perhaps at some of our OUS campuses. Is there any sort of policy either at the OUS system level or at the campus level that would determine that if in fact we get to the situation where we don't have capacity for in-state students, which might an institution be guided to have fewer of, international students or out-of-state students? Because I think in the eyes of the institution, they're worth about the same amount of money, right?
Is it? That's correct.
But does anybody, yeah. Has that topic come up at all, whether we would discourage international folks or out-of-state attendance to make sure that we have capacity for Oregon students?
All right. Yes, Chair Dembro, Rep. Johnson, members of the committee. That's something that clearly, at least in my time in the Chancellor's office, has been a campus-level decision, the mix, the building of the class. We've been hands-off about that, so no, we have not had conversations about that system-wide, to my knowledge.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Rep. Dembro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry if you discuss this a little further. I had to step out of the room and take an appointment for Vice Chair Harker. When you talk about the danger of losing more international students through unnecessary or stringent scrutiny, can you say more about that? Because I'm certainly concerned. I wouldn't want to lose them for both the economic benefit that you mentioned and, of course, the cultural. But given the numbers and the attractiveness and the, I don't want to call it pressure, but just the attractiveness of coming to this country, say more about the danger of losing them if we go, you know, the wrong direction and overreact or ask the wrong questions or the wrong people.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam, Chair Dembro. We have already heard rumblings from students who are being actively sought after by other countries, Australia and Canada, the English-speaking countries, the European Union is much more aggressively seeking the enrollment of international students and is offering more programs that are being taught in the English language. And I don't have concrete evidence. I have anecdotal evidence that students are talking about the fact that they feel like they're under a microscope when they're here. The vast majority of our students come here to get an education. I think the vast majority of them do still go home. In fact, we've been seeing in the last couple of years with the U.S. economy being more shaky that students are excited to go back home again and to take their knowledge and their learning back home with them. But I don't think there's any other country in the world where students receive the kind of scrutiny that our students receive. I mentioned in my testimony, we report three or four times a year to the federal government whether or not these students are enrolled. If a student fails a PE class, a one-credit PE class, they're considered to be in violation of their immigration status and by extension, theoretically, a threat to national security. I understand why these regulations are in place, and I do everything in my power to report to the federal government what I'm obliged to report, but I honestly don't believe that an undergraduate student who fails a PE class is a threat to national security, and I would dearly love to see a little bit more discretion given back to international student advisors who know these students personally. And no, we can't know exactly what they're doing in their private lives or in their off time, but there's a lot to be said for the human beings who walk into my office and for the relationship that I'm able to build with them, and so that I would like to see a little more, discretion. Thank you. Given back to international student advisors. I think that would go a long way to making these young people feel at home here.
Thank you for that comment, Christina. I do have a concern that we may be moving in the other direction now as part of the comprehensive immigration reform, which I think is a good thing, that there is more scrutiny being proposed over individuals who overstay their visas, right? I mean, there has been a misconception that most people who are here in illegal status cross the border, illegally, but, a very, very substantial number simply overstayed their visas. And so I think what's being proposed is to do more in that area. There would be a concern that perhaps, many innocent students would be caught up as a result of this. Have you heard any specific proposals being made about tightening up the scrutiny even further?
Thank you, Chair Dembrough. I'm trying to remember. I was reading a lot about immigration reform last week and talking a lot about it at the conference, and I'm in kind of post-conference shutdown at the moment. I don't recall any, just off the top of my head, any calls for further scrutiny of the international student population under immigration reform. I know that there's talk about eliminating the diversity lottery. I believe there's talk about expanding the number of H-1B visas, which could be construed as a good thing. But as I think Representative Gallegos said over here, there is concern that perhaps those jobs could be going to Americans.
Thank you.
Yes, Jim. Just one other thing, Chair Dembrough. Just because Rep. Johnson and Rep. Wisnant both suggested this, I would be happy to work with Christina to convene the designated school officials from all of the universities and perhaps invite the independent college and university ones. We'd be happy to do that.
I think that's a great idea. I will say, I have to add that my wife taught for many, many years as part of a language program at Lewis and Clark College. At times the director of that program, and they are a very tight-knit community, I think, is my understanding. Very often students who come to this country to do initial language training then move to one of the other independent colleges or to Portland State or to a community college, and everyone involved really stays in touch quite a lot. I think they take their responsibility as sort of in loco parentis, with the students very, very seriously. Okay, thank you very much for coming
thank
and sharing
you.
With us. Larry, you stay put.
Okay. So you guys
abandoned me. Chair Dembrough, just a preliminary comment that we would be pleased, and we do in other professional sub-disciplines have cooperation with the Oregon University system in the Human Resources Department and teacher education and other places where we have common ground. We try to reduce redundancy so each one of us is not developing the overhead necessary for training and professional development. So this is a we're happy to be a part of that. Let me say, too, that I much appreciate the committee's time, and I know this is a special accommodation owing to the fact that we ran out of time at the hearing on financial aid. And so I'm grateful that at this time of the session, we still want to take a little bit and learn about the financial aid, which I came specifically prepared to present today. And if I learn how to use the committee's computer here, we'll run through these, and it won't take very long. I have only about 8 slides. Can I open this? That's sort of step one, isn't it?
Can you? Is the question.
Oh, there's a button. Oh, okay. All right. Anyway, the focus of this is to develop a picture for you at a very high level of generalization about the financial aid patterns in the aggregate of the independent colleges and universities in Oregon. And if this seems not to work.
Yeah, we're still in the same.
There we go. Got it. Okay, here we go.
It's like your chair.
Yeah, for the record again, Representative Dembro, I'm Larry Large, president of the Oregon Independent Colleges and Universities. The way I want to break this down into 3 quick components here, one of them is the source of financial aid, where does the money come from? Secondly, how it's divided between graduates and undergraduates. And third, the character of the aid, whether it's grant, loans, work, or that sort of thing. The federal government is a big player in the source of financial aid. For the undergraduates, of 37% of all undergraduate aid in our colleges and universities, $188 million comes from federal sources. For the graduate students, it's even larger, and it's a very high percentage. And a total of, 56% of all of the financial aid that comes into the independent colleges comes from federal sources. The institution provides $280 million for the undergraduates, but a very small portion for the graduate study. A total of $300 million that the institutions in the aggregate turn back to the students, or provided through gifts, through endowments, and through other special assigned funds. There's a miscellaneous thing here. This would be like a service club scholarship, a Rotary scholarship that the student brings with her to the campus, or other kinds of locally funded financial aid to the students. Hardly any of that goes to graduate students. As you can see, it's disproportionate to the undergraduate students. Oregon provides, through the participation of our Oregon students in the Oregon Opportunity Grants, 1% or $4 million. And these data are from 2011 and 12, the academic year, fiscal year, that ended about 11 months ago. So we don't have new data for the current one at this point. Won't have it for another couple, three months. But we don't see much change. This is a fairly representative time here. And, of course, there's no money that goes to graduate students in that. Our students face the same means test. That is, they have to demonstrate need, they have to be from Oregon, and the amount of the grant is capped at the same level it is at the Oregon University system, which is last year was $1,950. Now, if you look at these numbers without loan or with loan, you can see that the total amount of undergraduate aid with loan is $504 million, without loan is $336 million, and at the graduate level, it's inverted radically in the other direction. So again, there's a total of, from all sources of student aid to our students, there's $750 million a year that flows to those students. Now, the type of aid, the grants, the undergraduates, more of it is in grant than it is in loan. 65%. And the grad students, of course, it's different than that. $342 million in direct aid, which is, doing the math, is a little short of half of what the total was of the $750 million. There are 2 kinds of loans. There are loans that are subsidized and those that aren't. And the subsidies come almost exclusively from federal programs. But you can see there that the numbers move around a little bit, and then there's a little bit of money that comes in the work accounts there. I'm running through this, but if you want to pause me at any point, I'd be happy to stop and clarify these. So the total aid is $750 million. $504 million of that goes to the undergraduate population. The graduate students receive the reciprocal or the remaining one-third.
Excuse me, Larry. Yes, we're
for things like student assistantships and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yep. These are another way to break it down here. This is an interesting metric, I think, because it's counter to the stereotype of our institutions in many respects. What that 35%, what it means to be eligible to receive a Pell Grant, and this is not a precise number, but it's a good benchmark. It's plus or minus $40,000 a year family income for a family of four that would be qualify for that. So these are low income students. And we have 35% of our students who qualify for the Pell Grant. So we're not just dealing with those students who come from wealthy families. And half of our students come from the state of Oregon. So these are, we're trying, our opportunity here is to serve the state's interests on 40-40-20. We want to deal with the Oregon demographics and to be able to provide the kind of educational services that will fuel a good Oregon economy in the future. 11% of our students receive opportunity grants. As I said, that's 1% of the funds. Percent of graduate aid that's in loans is 93%. I threw this one in here just to let you know that our schools are also sometimes formally and sometimes informally in reciprocal arrangements and transfer agreements with the community colleges. 28% of our students have community college experience when they enroll.
Yes, Representative.
Could you help me a little with that question? It looks like the second and third row are percentage of students, but the top row is percentage of aid. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the top one is the percentage of aid that is in loans for the undergraduates.
You have a sense of what percentage of students get loans?
That's a... Representative Chair Denborough, Representative Greenlick, I do, but it's not right at the top, front and center. I will get it to you in an email this afternoon.
Mm-hmm. Great.
This is something that the average debt at graduation, which is something we all want to be concerned about, and it's gotten a lot of national attention. It has implications that go far beyond the financing of American higher education, but for the economy in subsequent years. Our average debt is $26,000 for an undergraduate, and I think that's probably counter to some perceptions because our prices, tuition list prices, are so much higher. But because of the financial aid that you saw there, we are able to keep that debt down.
That's almost exactly the same as at OUS.
It's somewhere close to $1,000 greater at our institutions than it is at OUS.
Yes,
we're following it earlier. Yeah. The reason I asked that other question is, does this mean that 10% of your students have a $400,000 debt and 90% have?
No, this is a percentage of Chair Denborough and Representative Greenlake. These numbers are the percentages of, are the amounts for those who borrow. That is not averaged out over students who do not borrow. And the rough number, and I want to be more precise than before, the rough number is about 72% of our students take some form of loan during their undergraduate years.
Okay.
It's about 72%. But it's varied a little bit, and I don't want to give you the wrong impression. But it's close to it. It won't when I send you, won't deviate much from that metric.
Mm-hmm. Chair Deborah. Yeah. Actually, before you do, Rep. Gallegos, Joe, could you come back up so we can make sure we're comparing apples and apples? So, Joe, at OUS, the average of $25,000 roughly $1,000 a year. That's does that include all students? All students who began, as I understand, as I remember the number, it includes all those all the students who began, did all 4 years at the university.
Yes, Chair Denbrough, I believe that's correct. It's the cohort of first-time, full-time freshmen. And I would point out, too, since you called me back, that that is a mean average. It's a numerical average. So there still is the phenomenon that Rep. Greenlich is talking about, because you could have students borrowing very little and students borrowing a lot. And the median loan debt is lower. It's not a lot lower, but it is lower.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, we don't... Chair Denbrough, Representative Greenlich, we don't have in this metric zero zeros, but the median, if we track the median, it would be similar to what Joe has described for OUS. This is a number I wanted to show you.
Larry, before you go on, Rep. Gallegos.
Yeah, I just wanted to put some perspective on Representative Greenlich's question about the numbers. So, University of Portland, I don't know what it is now. It was, when you factored in tuition, meal tickets, campus housing, it was around 40,000, I think, a year or two ago. And I think that and this was an administration number. I don't know how accurate it is, but they would talk about 70 to 80% of the students getting financial aid of some size, and that would vary, obviously.
Yeah. Chair Denbrough, Representative Greenlich. At our institutions, the 92% across the 19 colleges and universities that are our group, which is the fully regionally accredited, not-for-profit, independent schools, 92% of first-time enrollees receive some form of aid.
Yeah.
Okay. I wanted to mention the Oregon Opportunity Grant recipients. We're real pleased with this because, generally speaking, graduation rates are inverted to from family income. And we feel real proud of this, that we are, our debt loads here are very similar to what they are for the average students, for those who are on those levels. And the graduation rates are these levels, and then I put this in quickly to show you that our Oregon Opportunity Grant students graduate in the six-year cohort identically to what the, on average, to what the our regular enrolled students, non-Oregon Opportunity Grant recipients, have. So, if you want a complete antidote to insomnia, I can provide it here. I will not try to interpret it. This is just another way to aggregate the data in our form. So, I'd be happy to take any further questions.
Larry, I know the data that you're presenting to us doesn't go into this, but do you have a sense of what the trends are, you know, in terms of financial aid? I think in general around the country we're seeing more of a shift from grants to loans, certainly in the public sector. Are we seeing something analogous in the independent world?
Chair Denbrough, I'm afraid that is the case. And the sources of grant aid are diminishing for the industry, whether one goes to an independent college or to a community college or to a public four-year institution. Our circumstances and our presidents worry about this, and our chief financial officers. The financial model that we're all operating on and have been for about the last 30 years of high tuition, high aid is coming under serious scrutiny. The average nationally of our kinds of institutions, this is not a state metric, nationally our average is running between 42 and 45% of the tuition is a discount. So that the actual tuition revenue is only coming in at 58% of gross. So it's this is a problem, and what you've heard me say informally, that what I worry about, most of what the industry has been focused on for the last 30 years has been on revenue. We have to pay some closer attention as managers and leaders of all of these colleges and universities on the cost structure. And when I say costs, I know that you can separate them, the cost of instruction, which have been fairly stable and are fairly low, particularly in Oregon. Our Oregon University system has done a marvelous job of restraining on those costs. But where the real increases have occurred in the cost of education and therefore reflected in the price, I'm an economist, so I'll want to make that distinction for you here, it has come in the form of services, regulation, technology, marketing, athletics sometimes, accreditation, a lot of auxiliary activities that have required investment in personnel. It's very intensive in that regard. I mean, that's a whole another lecture sometime, but it is the case that instruction costs have been fairly stable in the industry since 1994 to 2009. But the cost in those other services, campus security costs, healthcare on campuses, that are oftentimes not scalable, so that they become expensive. And you, anyway.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Larry. Rip Greenlee.
Yeah, I'd like to understand what you said. I'd like to follow it up with a comment. You're saying on average the tuition, let's say, is $50,000, the rack rate, if you will.
Okay.
And you get of that in terms of, because of discounting tuition for a variety of reasons, $35,000. I can't multiply 58% too easily in my head. Something like that. Why don't you just drop the price to that and not have to discount things? Because that would change, I suspect, the way people look at these.
Chair Dimbrough, Representative Greenlee, it's a terribly rational question that you pose. But on the other hand, if one were to just hold on and do that, our ability to serve lower income students would be compromised. And the mix of the student enrollment would be different in ways that we find not pedagogically appropriate or not or sound.
Yeah.
Again, this is a high tuition, high aid
right.
strategy,
mm-hmm.
And that I think that has traditionally been true, relatively speaking, mm-hmm. in the private sector and the independent world, as opposed to the public. But there are people in the public sector who've been calling for us moving in more in that direction as
Chair,
well.
Chair Dimbrough, that is happening in yeah. some institutions. I'm not intimately familiar with which ones and at what rates, but I know that a lot of flagship public universities are migrating to this as state appropriations over the years have been reduced. And it's like a hydraulic. You push down on the state appropriations, you push up on the tuition. And that's when that happens, then you've got the mix of students who can afford what the affordability challenges are for the citizens of those states.
Mm-hmm. Tell me this, Larry, and I don't know if you know this offhand, but the sort of, the gap between the tuition costs at an independent university and a public university, over time, has that remained fairly constant? Has the gap narrowed? Or?
Chair Dimbrough, it is the case that the gap is narrowing, even at the rack rate, but at the net rate, it's narrowed even more.
Right.
And we are able in this state, for example, we enroll 20% of all of the undergraduates enrolled in college at 4-year colleges in the state. We graduate 25%. We're proud of that. We think that's a good return on investment for the state for the small amount of fraction of the Oregon Opportunity Grant for our Oregon students. At the graduate level, we enroll 30% and graduate 28% and graduate 38% of the students. Now, we have a number of graduate programs which are not typically thought about as our group. Some of these are in the medical profession. We have one of the national leaders in chiropractic medicine in the University of Western States. The National College of Naturopathic Medicine is here. We have some seminaries. Those kinds of things that add to the graduate enrollment. We have two of the three states' law schools are independent. But that gap has, at the undergraduate level, has diminished.
Mm-hmm. Well, and just following up on that, When we look to the cost drivers in public higher education, OUS specifically, you know, we talk about the increased disinvestment by the state, you know, the state allocation going down. Some people believe that it's due to overly juicy benefit packages, you know, at those schools. But, you know, what you're suggesting is that there are other factors that are driving me, because the kinds of things that you're talking about that are pushing up the costs at the independent universities are also weighing on the publics, wouldn't you say?
Chair Dimbrough, I think that's true. I don't track it as closely, so I don't want to misrepresent expertise about that or intimate knowledge about it. But these other, I mean, when the federal government, if you look over the last 30 years, the amount of money that has been evolving and growing in Pell Grants, subsidized loans, you know, we're talking in the hundreds of billion. In the Pell Grant alone, it's $160-some billion a year. There will be accountability requirements that the Congress will put into that. And when that happens, then they have to have data, they have to have regulations, and the institutions have to track it. I'm not suggesting these are illegitimate costs. These are real costs that go with the operation of the institutions. Now, so that and the reporting requirements and the accreditation for eligibility to participate, you have to be accredited, among other tests that states and the federal government put into place for Title IV money, which is the federal financial aid package. Those cost money, and you have to track them, and there's just a higher level of accountability. And again, I'm not suggesting that's a wrong-headed thing. What I would suggest is we have to be careful to reduce redundancies as much as possible in overlapping reporting requirements between accreditation, state requirements, and federal requirements. The degree to which the same data can be used to satisfy those points of accountability is all to the good.
Thank you. Vice Chair Harker.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough. There has been a little bit of debate at times about whether or not Oregon Opportunity Grants should be used in the private schools. You showed a couple of data pieces here, one that about 1% of your students obtain Oregon Opportunity Grant funds, and also that the graduation rates are virtually identical for the undergrads. Do we know the graduation rates for Opportunity Grant recipients in the public domain?
Chair Dembrough, Rep. Harker, members of the committee, I believe that that information is available. If they received an Opportunity Grant and the percent, the graduation rate for them, we could do that.
Yes,
Chair Dembrough and Vice Chair Harker, they are working to gather that information there. The one complicating variable in getting the data is that the way that the Oregon Student Access Commission, as it's now known, maybe migrating to a new nomenclature, that the students are on a first-come, first-served basis, mm-hmm. if they're eligible, and you know there is a wide gap between those who apply, who are eligible, and the funding levels. Right now it's about 20%, as you heard Bob Brew testify here three weeks ago. So when the numbers that I'm using here include students who've had 1 year or 2 years, mm-hmm. because you can't always predict they're going to be continuing with their Opportunity Grant, but these numbers include anyone who's had it for at least 1 year.
And I should also further qualify my remarks that it's also students who are in that freshman cohort,
right.
that get tracked. It's not all students receiving an Opportunity Grant.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. At least at this time.
At this time, right.
Yeah. Thank you. Chair Dembrough, I might also say that among the other things that we do at the Alliance, we have a pretty aggressive fundraising program that we do in the collective for 10 of the primarily undergraduate colleges in our 19 schools. We actually raise corporate dollars to support exclusively student financial aid at the campuses for the very reasons of these gaps and the ability to serve Oregon students who are representative of the demographic. We also enroll minority students at the levels. 1 in 5 of our students is an ethnic minority student.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Thanks for coming back up, Joe. And Larry, thanks for coming and staying.
Well, and thank you for accommodating after. I know this time of the year is really tough for all of you, so appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, we didn't get invited to Mahonia, so we're...
yeah, we're free right now. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing. If there are no other questions or comments, we are adjourned.